12. Ideas for Action. Building habits of group vulnerability is like building a muscle. It takes time, repetition, and the willingness to feel pain in order to achieve gains. And as with building muscle, the first key is to approach the process with a plan. With that in mind, here are a few workout ideas for both individuals and groups. Make sure the leader is vulnerable first and often. As we've seen, group cooperation is created by small, frequently repeated moments of vulnerability. Of these, none carries more power than the moment when a leader signals vulnerability. As Dave Cooper says, "I screwed that up," are the most important words any leader can say. I saw a vivid example when I watched restaurateur Danny Meyer run one of his morning meetings with his staff, about 20 people. Meyer, whom we'll meet up close in Chapter 15, is the founder of Union Square Cafe, Shake Shack, Gramercy Tavern, and a number of other restaurants that together are worth more than $1 billion. The night before my visit, he had delivered his first ever TED Talk. The staff meeting began with the group watching a video of Meyer's speech. Then the lights went up, and Meyer spoke. "Can you see my leg shaking?" he asked the group. "I was so nervous, I was shaking like a leaf. I've given a lot of speeches, but the TED people wanted something more, something deeper and thoughtful. So I slept about 3 hours the night before, which is why I have those bags under my eyes. We had a terrible rehearsal, and I kept screwing up the PowerPoint. So it was almost a complete shit show. Except that I'm lucky enough to have some absolutely brilliant help." He paused and pointed. "Thanks, Chip and Haley. They made the whole thing work. They wrote great stuff, gave me great advice, and kept me together." Everyone looked at Chip and Haley and gave a short round of applause, while Meyer looked on approvingly. Meyer delivered the message, "I was scared," with steadiness, confidence, and comfort that underlined the deeper message, "It's safe to tell the truth here." His vulnerability isn't weakness, it's his strength. Laszlo Bock, former head of people analytics at Google, recommends that leaders ask their people 3 questions. What is one thing that I currently do that you'd like me to continue to do? What is one thing that I don't currently do frequently enough that you think I should do more often? What can I do to make you more effective? The key is to ask not for 5 or 10 things, but just 1, Bock says. That way it's easier for people to answer. And when a leader asks for feedback in this way, it makes it safe for the people who work with them to do the same. It can get contagious. Overcommunicate expectations. The successful groups I visited did not presume that cooperation would happen on its own. Instead, they were explicit and persistent about sending big, clear signals that established those expectations, modeled cooperation, and aligned language and roles to maximize helping behavior. IDEO is a good example. Its leaders constantly talk about the expectation of cooperation. CEO Tim Brown incessantly repeats his mantra that the more complex the problem, the more help you need to solve it. They clearly define helping roles and model vulnerability. Their internal bulletin boards are filled with requests. Does anybody know of a good yoga class? Can anybody help me find a cat sitter for Christmas week? In case you missed those signals, they are also written in big letters both on the walls of the New York office and in the pages of the Little Book of IDEO, a copy of which is given to every employee. Among the refrains, collaborate and make others successful. Going out of your way to help others is the secret sauce. Deliver the negative stuff in person. This was an informal rule that I encountered at several cultures. It goes like this. If you have negative news or feedback to give someone, even as small as a rejected item on an expense report, you are obligated to deliver that news face to face. This rule is not easy to follow, It's far more comfortable for both the sender and receiver to communicate electronically. But it works because it deals with tension in an upfront, honest way that avoids misunderstandings and creates shared clarity and connection. One of the best methods for handling negative news is that of Joe Maddon, the coach of the Chicago Cubs and avowed enophile. In his office, Maddon keeps a glass bowl filled with slips of paper, each inscribed with the name of an expensive wine. When a player violates a team rule, Maddon asks them to draw a slip of paper out of the bowl, purchase that wine, and uncork it with their manager. In other words, Maddon links the act of discipline to the act of reconnection. When forming new groups, focus on two critical moments. Jeff Polzer, the Harvard Business School professor who studies organizational behavior, from Chapter 8, traces any group's cooperation norms to two critical moments that happen early in the group's life. They are 1. The first vulnerability. 2. The first disagreement. These small moments are doorways to two possible group paths. Are we about appearing strong or about exploring the landscape together? Are we about winning interactions or about learning together? At those moments, people either dig in and become defensive and start justifying, and a lot of tension gets created, Polzer says. Or they say something like, "Hey, that's interesting. Why don't you agree? I might be wrong, and I'm curious and want to talk about it some more." What happens in that moment helps set the pattern for everything that follows. Listen like a trampoline. Good listening is about more than nodding attentively. It's about adding insight and creating moments of mutual discovery. Jack Zanger and Joseph Folkman, who run a leadership consultancy, analyzed 3,492 participants in a manager development program and found that the most effective listeners do four things. 1. They interact in ways that make the other person feel safe and supported. 2. They take a helping, cooperative stance. 3. They occasionally ask questions that gently and constructively challenge old assumptions. 4. They make occasional suggestions to open up alternative paths. As Zanger and Folkman put it, the most effective listeners behave like trampolines. They aren't passive sponges. They are active responders, absorbing what the other person gives, supporting them, and adding energy to help the conversation gain velocity and altitude. Also like trampolines, effective listeners gain amplitude through repetition. When asking questions, they rarely stop at the first response. Rather, they find different ways to explore an area of tension in order to reveal the truths and connections that will enable cooperation. I've found that whenever you ask a question, the first response you get is usually not the answer. It's just the first response, Roshi Gavichi says. So I try to find ways to slowly surface things, to bring out what ought to be shared so that people can build from it. You have to find a lot of ways to ask the same question and approach the same question from a lot of different angles. Then you have to build questions from that response to explore more. In conversation, resist the temptation to reflexively add value. The most important part of creating vulnerability often resides not in what you say, but in what you do not say. This means having the willpower to forego easy opportunities to offer solutions and make suggestions. Skilled listeners do not interrupt with phrases like, "Hey, here's an idea," or, "Let me tell you what worked for me in a similar situation," because they understand that it's not about them. They use a repertoire of gestures and phrases that keep the other person talking. "One of the things I say most often is probably the simplest thing I say," says Gavichi. "Say more about that." It's not that suggestions are off limits. Rather, they should be made only after you establish what Gavichi calls a scaffold of thoughtfulness. The scaffold underlies the conversation, supporting the risks and vulnerabilities. With the scaffold, people will be supported in taking the risks that cooperation requires. Without it, the conversation collapses. Use candor-generating practices like AARs, brain trusts, and red teaming. While AARs were originally built for the military environment, the tool can be applied to other domains. One good AAR structure is to use 5 questions. 1. What were our intended results? 2. What were our actual results? 3. What caused our results? 4. What will we do the same next time? 5. What will we do differently? Some teams also use a before action review, which is built around a similar set of questions. 1. What are our intended results? 2. What challenges can we anticipate? 3. What have we or others learned from similar situations? 4. What will make us successful this time? A couple of tips. It may be useful to follow the SEALs' habit of running the AAR without leadership involvement to boost openness and honesty. Likewise, it may be useful to write down the findings, particularly what will be done the same or differently next time, and share them across the group. After all, the goal of an AAR is not just to figure out what happened, but also to build a shared mental model that helps the group navigate future problems. Brain trusts, the project-based method pioneered by Pixar, involve assembling a team of experienced leaders who have no formal authority over the project and letting them critique its strengths and weaknesses in a frank and open manner. A key rule of brain trusts is that the team is not allowed to suggest solutions, only to highlight problems. This rule maintains the project leader's ownership of the task and helps prevent them from assuming a passive, order-taking role. Red teaming is a military-derived method for testing strategies. You create a red team to come up with ideas to disrupt or defeat your proposed plan. The key is to select a red team that is not wedded to the existing plan in any way, and to give them freedom to think in new ways that the planners might not have anticipated. AARs, brain trusts, and red teams each generate the same underlying action: to build the habit of opening up vulnerabilities so that the group can better understand what works, what doesn't work, and how to get better. Aim for candor. Avoid brutal honesty. Giving honest feedback is tricky because it can easily result in people feeling hurt or demoralized. One useful distinction, made most clearly at Pixar, is to aim for candor and avoid brutal honesty. By aiming for candor, feedback that is smaller, more targeted, less personal, less judgmental, and equally impactful, it's easier to maintain a sense of safety and belonging in the group. Embrace the discomfort. One of the most difficult things about creating habits of vulnerability is that it requires a group to endure 2 discomforts, emotional pain and a sense of inefficiency. Doing an AAR or a brain trust combines the repetition of digging into something that already happened, shouldn't we be moving forward, with the burning awkwardness inherent in confronting unpleasant truths. But as with any workout, the key is to understand that the pain is not a problem, but the path to building a stronger group. Align language with action. Many highly cooperative groups use language to reinforce their interdependence. For example, Navy pilots returning to aircraft carriers do not land but are recovered. IDEO doesn't have project managers, it has design community leaders. Groups at Pixar do not offer notes on early versions of films, they plus them by offering solutions to problems. These might seem like small semantic differences, but they matter because they continually highlight the cooperative, interconnected nature of the work and reinforce the group's shared identity. Build a wall between performance review and professional development. While it seems natural to hold these two conversations together, in fact, it's more effective to keep performance review and professional development separate. Performance evaluation tends to be a high-risk, inevitably judgmental interaction, often with salary-related consequences. Development, on the other hand, is about identifying strengths and providing support and opportunities for growth. Linking them into one conversation muddies the waters. Relatedly, many groups have moved away from ranking workers and shifted to more of a coaching model, where people receive frequent feedback designed to provide them with both a vivid performance snapshot and a path for improvement. Use flash mentoring. One of the best techniques I've seen for creating cooperation in a group is flash mentoring. It is exactly like traditional mentoring. You pick someone you want to learn from and shadow them, except that instead of months or years, it lasts a few hours. Those brief interactions help break down barriers inside a group, build relationships, and facilitate the awareness that fuels helping behavior. Make the leader occasionally disappear. Several leaders of successful groups have the habit of leaving the group alone at key moments. One of the best at this is Greg Popovich. Most NBA teams run timeouts according to a choreographed protocol. First, the coaches huddle as a group for a few seconds to settle on a message, then they walk over to the bench to deliver that message to the players. However, during about one timeout a month, the Spurs coaches huddle for a timeout and then never walk over to the players. The players sit on the bench, waiting for Popovich to show up. Then, as they belatedly realize he isn't coming, they take charge, start talking among themselves, and figure out a plan. The New Zealand All Blacks rugby team have made a habit of this, as players lead several practice sessions each week with little input from the coaches. When I asked Dave Cooper to name the single trait that his best-performing SEAL teams shared, he said, "The best teams tended to be the ones I wasn't that involved with, especially when it came to training. They would disappear and not rely on me at all. They were better at figuring out what they needed to do themselves than I could ever be."